My name is Farouk Sadiq. I'm a long-time community activist, right from the days, in fact, of the Bosnian War in Europe. We set up a charity called Convoy of Mercy. We drove down to deliver aid from Bristol to Bosnia. We called it the tagline, and then we moved on to, or I moved on to, doing a bit more community work away from our businesses. We set up a local charity called the Bristol Muslim Culture Society. We did a lot of work following 9/11, or rather coincidentally, 9/11 happened just at the same time of our summer launch. And as we developed, it became the premier Muslim organization in the city. We set up a Muslim forum, a load of community programs and projects. I then became a government advisor, advising government on policies against counterterrorism, and I became the lead for that policy in the Southwest. And currently, I'm going back into business. I remain a community activist, going back into business, and have, for my sins, set up a restaurant.
Okay, well, maybe we can plug the restaurant at the end. But look,
Okay.
let's talk about Pakistan because give us an idea of the scale of Bristol's Pakistani community, Farouk.
So, in total, the Muslim community make up around 50,000 of the community here. And of that, I would say probably about 15, the majority, if not half, is around between the Pakistani and Somali communities, are the two largest communities. So yeah, you're looking at around 15,000-ish of Pakistani community in the UK, in Bristol, sorry.
Yeah, so obviously Bristol has a great interest in what's going on in Pakistan. Pakistan is, let's first say, was rather rudely divided by good old Mountie, they call him Mountbatten, into the with the Indian subcontinent, with the Hindu areas and the Muslim areas. So Pakistan becoming Muslim. The idea is really that it. That these two separate kind of communities, as they were under the British rule in India, and they decided to split it. I'd like to hear from you, and of course, maybe bring the Kashmir issue in if you wish, whether you think that that was the right decision the British made, or whether it was deliberately muddying the waters.
Oh no, I think Pakistan itself was set up to fail. The borders that were divided made sure, for example, that all of the arsenals, the army, for example, was all in India. And the plan was that this state would be a fledgling state that couldn't really survive on its own. And Pakistan actually defied that in the initial few decades, up until the 1960s, early 70s, I would say. Pakistan was doing exceedingly well, despite the odds against it, was far more developed and far more economically successful than its much bigger counterpart, India. And then the corruption set in. Corruption set in, the divisive politics set in, and you had the dynastic politics coming in, the bureaucracy became corrupt, and then you had a gradual decline in what Pakistan achieved. And eventually, now, as you can see, India has far exceeded Pakistan, and Pakistan's left wandering in the wilderness by itself. There were days when PIA, which is a Pakistan national airline, was one of the premier airlines in the world, competing along the sides of TWA in those days. They had ads in the major newspapers of America. They taught, they in fact helped develop what later became Emirates, which then went on to become all the pilots in Singapore Airlines, was also trained by PIA. The Emirates were trained by PIA. A number of the Gulf countries were trained by PIA, and then, as I said, the corruption set in into the Pakistani mindset, or if you like, if you the country, the bureaucracy, the politics across the sphere, and into general society itself. And we have the state where we are at the moment,
Well,
and then
look, I
after
mean, in the
all these.
meantime, Pakistan also did acquire nuclear weapons. I mean, this is something people often forget. So this almost is almost like a kind of poison chalice because it turns a state into a place that the Americans or the superpowers anyway, particularly the Americans, cannot afford to have an independent mind.
Yeah, and that's exactly what has happened. Pakistan's, what's the word, insecurity about itself, being, you know, with a much, much bigger and every now and then threatening neighbor who threatens to take Pakistan back into its fold regularly. It had a need for that self-defense, so that security against India was paramount in its thought process, in its mindset, in its psyche. And the development of nuclear weapons, because India was developing nuclear weapons, the Pakistanis felt they had no choice. And despite the fact that it was the Pakistanis that kept getting sanctioned for trying to develop nuclear weapons, and India was allowed to develop them unhindered almost, everyone knew that both India and Pakistan had nuclear weapons. And as soon as India got its nuclear weapon, it started to saber rattle. It started to threaten Pakistan. The BJP, which was then in the opposition, started to saber rattle against Pakistan, saying now's the time. They were proud of their nuclear development. Now's the time to take Pakistan back by force. And those 2 or 3 weeks, which I remember actually, the media newspapers were going crazy about invading Pakistan. Indian newspapers were talking about invading Pakistan and taking it back because we are now a nuclear power, etc., etc. And the Pakistanis then, and they thought it was a bluff that Pakistan had nuclear weapons. And then India obviously exploded their nuclear device to prove to the world, as I said, and saber rattling started. And that, I think, 7 days later, despite all the pressure not to do the same, Pakistan felt it had no choice but to then test its own nuclear device. And then the Indian politicians completely went on the back foot and said, well, see, this is the saber rattling. This is what causes, this is the response of the saber rattling by the BJP. But yeah, it reset the lines then. But Kashmir, which was left as a, from the outset, was left as a sore point between the two countries. Wars were fought over it, and half of it's in Pakistan and the other half of it's in India. That remains an open wound between the two countries, and the risk of a conflict again. I live on the border, actually. So from in Pakistan, my ancestral home is literally on the border between Pakistan, Kashmir. I live in Kashmir, but it's on the border. So from my village, you can literally see Pakistan and India on the other side, the mountains of India. And every time I go back to Pakistan, you hear the skirmishes on the border. You can hear the rocket fire. You can hear the artillery shells landing and firing. For example, over some of the most stupidest things you could think of, like a cricket match. There's a match between Pakistan and India. Depending on who wins, the other the losing side fires off missiles, artillery shells at the opposing
side. Now, I know the Indian Army has been occupying Kashmir. Can you tell us what the situation is now?
It remains under Indian occupation. The vast majority of the overwhelming majority of Pakistan, of Kashmir, sorry, remains, and it's locked out. So you can't get. It is the most heavily militarized area in the world. So you have Pakistan's, for example, Pakistan's full standing army is, I believe, just under 600,000. That's their full, which is pretty large. India has 600,000 troops stationed in Kashmir, in the occupied Kashmir alone. So you can imagine the militarization of that area. Nothing is allowed in or out of Kashmir and Indian occupied Kashmir, and that remains the case to this day. In fact, a couple of years back, they actually annexed it completely against international commitment. The international commitment is that both India and Pakistan will hold elections in their respective occupied Kashmirs. So, and the outcome of that election will decide which way Pakistan, which way Kashmir goes. India has point blank refused consistently to hold those elections, despite committing to do so from the outset. Pakistan has always said, as soon as India holds it, we'll hold it. We've got no issues. Let the people of Kashmir decide whether they want to be part of Pakistan, whether they want to be part of India, or indeed whether they want to be independent. Yeah. And India has refused point blank and has actually strengthened its occupation of Indian Kashmir.
I mean, people listening might will think, well, the Hindu India and Muslim Pakistan, they're like oil and water. They can never mix. Maybe Mountbatten was right to separate the two countries.
Well, that goes against actual historical record, because Hindus and Muslims lived literally side by side in every village, in every city, in every town before the British came. And I remember still in Hansard, actually, the record, I forget the gentleman's name, and he traveled, and this was a precursor to the East India Company being set up, but he traveled the length and breadth of India, and when it was under Mughal, when the Mughals ruled, etc., and there was other Hindu Rajas across the different states. And he said he had yet to come across a poor person in India. There was no strife. There was no communal issues. We were living side by side. And he actually records his recollection as he comes back to the parliament and makes a speech about what he saw and says there's wealth in that land. And his key element, he says at the end of his speech, is that it would be so easy to conquer that territory because the people are so welcoming, so nice, that they will be easily conquered. That was then led to the expeditions that then even initially formed the East India Company. And the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, well, look, let's bring this back up to date, because we have Imran Khan now in prison, the famous cricketer, the man. I mean, actually, cricket in a way is so symbolic, isn't it, of a fair match, a fair game, where the British used to like to play cricket, and when the Americans would unfairly win various games out on the international scene, everyone would say, this is not cricket. But Imran Khan is now back in jail again. Can you just take us through the latest, and also let us know what's been going on during these elections? Because I know his party has done incredibly well, but it looks like it's still, in fact, got the largest number of votes in these most recent elections. So maybe you could just take us through how fair that election was and how it's all playing out for Khan and for the country.
So the Imran Khan was seen as a threat by the Pakistani ruling military. Now, it's known as the establishment. Nobody really names it, but everyone knows that behind the scenes, the Pakistani military is the power broker. And unfortunately, in the last 2 years since Imran Khan was removed from power by the military using the opposition, that has become more and more apparent, unlike it has ever been before. Before, it was unsaid. Nobody talked about it. It was just people blame corrupt politicians. In the last 2 years, what has happened and the crackdown on Imran Khan and his party, unheard of levels of subjugation and oppression. So, for example, here we consider the Englishman's home is his castle. We have the very same concept in Pakistan, where the police or anyone looking for, say they're doing an investigation, you do not enter anyone's property. It's just a no-go. You don't do it. You seek permission, you get permission, and you get permission from the residents to enter because you've got women and children there. And it's just seen as basic Islamic, Pakistani cultural etiquette that the authorities do not enter a person's home without being invited to do so. And that is a major cornerstone of Pakistani society. That has been broken forever under the crackdown that took place on Imran Khan, where women were dragged, bedrooms were broken into, a video of women being beaten by male police officers, their hair being dragged by male police officers in protests, women being dragged by their hair, beaten up, arrested, tortured. I mean, this has never happened before on such a wide scale that we've seen in the last 2 years. And all of that was as a result of what they call, you know, what the army called May 9th, when Imran did a nationwide protest and a march for liberation. And he marched up and down the country and culminated in Islamabad, the nation's capital. And the people were ready to fight. And Imran Khan at the last minute called it off because he didn't want a riot. He didn't want to break law and order to break down. So he pulled back. And that was the pinnacle of his power. And unfortunately, rather than the military understanding that the public was with Imran, they used that opportunity to absolutely suppress Imran Khan and his party and take that opportunity as this is his weakness. And instead of him, you know, looking, thinking about the country in the long term, they decided now is the time to crush Imran Khan when he pulled back the people and said, look, go home. I don't want to fight here. That was, I believe it was a mistake. The people power could have proven once and for all where they stood, and they were proving it. They broke down all the barriers at that stage. Imran Khan was then arrested. He was put in prison. His party was cracked down on. And every time they did it, Imran Khan became more and more popular, and the worse the oppression got. Journalists disappeared. Anyone who spoke out in support of Imran Khan disappeared. Young TikTokers who were making videos in support of Imran Khan were being arrested. When I say young, I'm talking about teenagers. So they were hunted down where these TikToks were being, videos were being made, whose home, and would just break in, smash their homes up, threaten their families, take the kids into prison without charge, disappeared for months on end. Major famous journalists. One was actually, I believe, killed in Kenya, I think it was, when he was trying to run from the oppression. He went to Dubai first, and then Dubai was pressured by the military to get him out of Dubai. He then went to Kenya, where he was then, I believe he was assassinated by the Pakistani military establishment. They deny it. That led to an outpouring of grief and anger on the streets of Pakistan. But they carried on. They carried on. Other journalists disappeared. One of the most eloquent, Imran Khan Riaz, was one of the most eloquent, the most popular YouTube channel, clearly a supporter of Imran Khan. He was arrested. First, he was threatened. His family was threatened. His business interests were threatened. And then he was just disappeared. He was just literally picked up. We didn't see him for months on end. And then when he finally came back, he couldn't speak. He'd completely, his physical appearance had completely changed. He couldn't talk at all. Apparently, what they did was place a coal, a lit coal, on his tongue to stop him speaking because his power of words was so amazing. He's only just recovered. And is now, after months and months of being silent, has only now just come back with his YouTube channel, which is even more watched than ever before. So all this has been going on. So then, despite not being able to do that, they then cracked down on the party itself. So the PTI name, you couldn't mention Imran Khan on television. The media wasn't allowed to mention his name. No anchor was allowed to mention Imran Khan's name on television. You couldn't see Imran Khan. He does a yearly campaign for his cancer hospital. No channel could run that. The telethon was banned. And Imran Khan was literally taken off TV. You couldn't share his image. You couldn't share his name. That wasn't enough. Then the elections, as the elections arose, people, the army realized that Imran Khan was still even more popular than before. The bigger the crackdown, the more popular he was getting. So then in a country that is largely illiterate, people, when they go to vote, they look for a symbol. And Imran Khan's symbol was the bat, the cricket bat. And people recognize that and they know who to vote for. So the army even took that away, that Imran Khan no longer could be using the PTI name. Can't mention it. You can't use his name. Can't mention it. Now you can't even use the symbol of the cricket bat. These were and all the top leadership of the Pakistani Tehreek-e-Insaf, which is Imran Khan's party, all of them were in hiding or arrested or behind bars at the time of the election. Despite all of that, the Pakistani people still came out and voted overwhelmingly for candidates who could no longer stand as PTI candidates. They had to stand as independent candidates. That way, that this was a conscious decision by the party that no one would raise the PTI flag because otherwise they'd just come and arrest you. You couldn't mention PTI because otherwise they'd just come and arrest you. You couldn't use the name of PTI. So people stood on their own name, but they had to do a campaign on social media to say this candidate, this person's name is the one that Imran Khan is backing. He won. Those candidates won by a landslide. So on the night of the election, as the tickers were coming in, as the count was coming in, normally the count is completed by 10 o'clock in the evening. No results started coming in, and Imran Khan at that stage had already got 134 votes. The ticker was on television, everyone was watching it. 134 seats to Imran Khan compared to 17 for the nearest opposition, which was PML Noon, Rajiv. And underneath that, I think 10 for the PPP, which is Benazir. And then suddenly the count stopped. The count stopped and it didn't restart for another 24 hours, which is illegal, by the way, by Pakistan's constitution. Didn't restart until 24 hours later. When the count restarted, Imran Khan party had dropped from 154 seats, sorry, all of a sudden when the count stopped, to 70 seats. And the others had jumped up to around 60 seats. And the count started from there. Even by all of that, by all of the pre-election rigging and the aftermath of the shutdown and the break, stopping the internet and everything, mobile networks were shut down. Imran Khan still became the single largest party in Pakistan, which is incredible response from the Pakistani people. And now, the two other parties, which had no chance, have decided that they're going to form a government in opposition. So combined with Imran Khan's now seats that they've taken away from him, they reckon they've got enough to form their own government. So that's where we are at the moment.
This is not doesn't bode well for the country. Again, Khan has been shut out of politics. Obviously, he can't really run the country from within prison anyway, can he?
Well, he ran a fantastic election campaign from behind bars, but you're right. I mean, it doesn't bode well for the future. The number of people that came out and had their mandate stolen, obviously people are upset. For example, in Balochistan, hardly covered by the media because it's banned in Pakistan, there were roads blocked. For days, you couldn't get anything in or out of that state because people were protesting the vote. And then the army came down, did a crackdown, no media coverage, just on social media that people were getting. You can watch NetBlocks, which is an international organization which watches how internet is being used. For example, wherever a nation cuts the internet or mobile services, they log it.
Like in Gaza, for example.
Exactly the same. And if you watch NetBlocks, their updates, the number of times Pakistan has shut down, second only to what's happening in Israel, the number of times the Pakistani military has shut down internet and mobile access in Pakistan is shocking for a nation of that size and the 250 million people. It is shocking. But now everyone knows what's happening. So, for example, at the moment, there's an international cricket tournament going on in Pakistan, the Pakistan Super League 2020 tournament. And people are going, joining the crowd and shouting pro Imran Khan slogans. And the army has to, or the police are being coming in to shut the people down, to remove them from stadiums. And now people are saying, well, let's boycott. If you can't raise our voices in a cricket match, let's boycott the cricket match. But yeah, so if you watch that, you can hear people shouting.
Where do you think this leaves Pakistan now, though? Because obviously there are forces, and maybe you can talk about who those forces are, how they're organised, you know, what their motive is, that are making sure that the people are not allowed to express their view in Pakistan anymore.
Yeah, so it's quite clear that what's happened here is as a result of direct American intervention. I mean, Donald Liu was an Undersecretary of State American Undersecretary of State, who made it clear to the Pakistani army that remove Imran Khan, because do you remember when Imran Khan went to Russia the day Putin launched the war on Ukraine? Imran decided that he wasn't going to cut the Ash tour short. So he continued, he stayed there because he said, look, what he was there for was pre-decided, pre-planned, and it was nothing to do with the war situation. He was there to get a good deal for crops and oil supply, which is what gas and oil supply, which is what Pakistan at that time desperately needed. So he thought about his people. His motto was Pakistan first, but he also then condemned what Putin did in Ukraine. No, sorry, he didn't condemn what Putin did in Ukraine. And instead, he stayed there. The Americans took serious objection to that. And then when he came back, the Americans asked him to condemn it. And he then, Imran Khan then turned around, because Imran Khan has said this, that he then was told by the Americans to condemn what Putin had done. And instead of condemning it, Imran Khan simply said, look, we call for peace. Invading another country is not the way forward to resolve any issues. And in the end, you're going to have to talk things through. So he said a statement like that, which was not strong enough for Imran Khan, for the Americans. And Imran Khan said, look, I cannot be standing next to Putin and not have said anything. And then I come home and then say it behind his back. That's cowardice. So I'm not going to say something that I wouldn't have said to his face. But I will say that I'm against this. I will say, and he did say, that he's against war. He's a pacifist himself, and war never solves anything. And everything has to be eventually resolved by peace. But he also made clear that Ukraine wasn't a major issue for Pakistan, because he said his issue was the West. It seems to me that the West wants us, the Pakistanis and the southern world in general, to jump when the West wants us to jump. But when we have issues, nobody cares. For example, Palestine, Kashmir, etc., etc. When our issues come to the fore, the West doesn't give a damn about these issues, but suddenly we have to jump up and down and scream and shout at the speeches that we're given to read out. I'm not doing that. As a result of that, Donald Liu, and he also asked, Pakistan was also asked to arm the Ukrainians, send them artillery to the Ukrainians. Imran Khan felt the need to refuse to do that. For whatever justification he had, he decided he was not going to get involved in that, as I said, because he thinks it was not a conflict that he needs to get involved in. He had more pressing issues at home to deal with. He did not have the luxury to have a moral standpoint at this stage in life. He couldn't do it. His people were going through poverty, had just come out of COVID, etc. So his stand was quite clear. That upset the Americans, and they decided to have a meeting with the opposition of Pakistan. And they said quite clearly, well recorded and widely reported and not denied by the opposition parties, that Donald Liu then said, and it was sent in a demarcation, a diplomatic, I can't remember the word now, it's a diplomatic letter, telling the Pakistani opposition that if you, and the military, that if you remove Imran Khan, we'll forgive you. And lo and behold, I think it was two days later, the process started against Imran Khan, which was to remove him from power. He was the prime minister at the time. No confidence motion. That was started by the opposition, tabled literally 2 days after the American Undersecretary of State, Donald Liu, told the opposition and the army to remove Imran Khan. And he specifically says in that letter, reported by the ambassador of Pakistan in America, that it specifically said that the no confidence motion in the Pakistani parliament must succeed. If it succeeds, then we'll forgive your issues, the Pakistani military. At that stage, there was no confidence. No confidence motion in Pakistan parliament had not been tabled. So this was 2 days before no confidence motion was tabled against Imran Khan. It was tabled. Imran Khan lost that no confidence motion. by all of the opposition, which despised each other up to that point, couldn't sit around the same table as each other up to that point. The only thing that united them was Imran Khan, their opposition to Imran Khan in their own way. And this opposition had literally said to each other that, I'm going to drag you through the streets, I'm going to wipe out you, or I'm going to drag the money you stole from the country. So these are the kinds of conversations that the opposition was having amongst itself, accusing each other. And then suddenly, 2 days after Donald Liu's proclamation, they all unite, unheard of, never done before. They've tabled a no confidence motion, which has never succeeded in Pakistani history, never. And Imran Khan was ousted as prime minister. And in the end, he became more powerful once he was ousted. And you have a system in place right now where the government, the establishment, a euphemism for the military, has decided it's going to use the opposition again to form the same kind of coalition government that they did when they ousted Imran Khan, and see how that goes. And that's where we are. And unfortunately, it doesn't bode well for the country.
No, not at all. Do you ever wonder whether this may be encouraging closer ties with Iran? Obviously, the Americans don't like the Iranians. And if you look at Pakistan geographically, you're kind of sandwiched between India and Iran, aren't you? What about this, your Western neighbour? Do you find that there is sympathies in Pakistan for the Iranian position when it comes to, you know, they actually call the United States Satan and the devil and this sort of thing. And one does wonder whether, you know, Pakistan has more in common cause with the Iranians, especially if the US is interfering to such an extent in basically denying them any kind of democratic control of their own country.
In many ways, it's not just Iran. It's Afghanistan, Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, which has such a massive border with Pakistan along the Durand Line, as they call it. Again, another British border, artificial border. And there, the Pakistanis have been bombing Afghanistan at the behest of the Americans. So this is the issue that Imran Khan has been raising throughout. This is what he refused to do during his tenure, was he said, we are no longer going to be guns for hire, which he felt that's what the Pakistani army had become, that it was doing the US bidding for the Americans at the cost of its own people and its own aspirations and its own interests. And as soon as the new government came into power, as soon as they ousted Imran Khan, suddenly you saw again, for the first time after many years, you saw drones attacking inside Afghanistan. And then suddenly Pakistan started saber rattling against the Afghan, the Taliban-led government. And then following that, there was a bit of argy-bargy on the borders. Borders were closed, led to a lot of border between Afghanistan and Pakistan was closed, led to a lot of hardship. And eventually the Pakistani government then decided it was going to send all the Afghan refugees back across Afghanistan. Now, there's no real reason to do that apart from cause hardship for a country. Remember, Afghanistan, their funds have been frozen. $10 billion of funds have been frozen by the international community, by America. So the Taliban don't have any money to look after the people that are currently in Pakistan. But for some reason beyond anyone's understanding, the Pakistanis decided that they were going to send all of these over a million, 1.5 million refugees back to Afghanistan all of a sudden. Now, this creates hardship for the Taliban government, and that's what it was obviously designed to do. But it also creates issues in Pakistan.
We'd be remiss to not ask you about Gaza. Do you think the Arab countries are right not to intervene? Some of them are suggesting that it's almost a kind of trap. They want to escalate something in Palestine, and they would actually rather do that because that might bring in the Americans. It might actually bring in some more of the superpowers. So the Israelis may have an agenda, which is to use the Gazans as kind of bait to widen the war. What do you make of what's happening there anyway?
It's viable. I mean, that is a. It's not. I don't think it's without legs, that theory. But I also think that it's an excuse. It's a cop out for the Arabs who. I think what's happening in Gaza is a further of economic interest. I mean, the way that what we're seeing there is pure genocide taking place, and the way the media, corporations, any criticism of it, it's at levels I've never seen in any sphere before, in any conflict, the level is just unbelievable. And the way you try to ban certain words, certain statements, certain people, protests, I mean, the very basic fabric of democratic society, we're going out of our way to undermine all of it for the sake of what? For Israel. So it's not the country, these are not wars between countries anymore. These are corporations that have found a piece of land that they believe that is an ideal a place to develop whatever they think they're doing. You're clearly seeing ethnic cleansing taking place. And the Arabs, just like anyone else, the top leadership have got a hand in that. They're getting something out of it. I mean, they can say, look, we don't want to get involved because it's a trap by Israel to widen the conflict. I've no doubt that Israel wants to widen the conflict. Goodness sake, it's attacking at the moment. It's doing ethnic cleansing in Gaza. It's bombing Syria. It's bombing Lebanon. It's bombing anywhere that it can think of. It's attacked three countries so far. And obviously it wants other people to get involved so it can do that. But the Arabs are a lot more powerful than they give you credit for. They can, if they want to do something, they can do it. Of course, look at Yemen. One tiny little country who hasn't killed a single soul, that they are considered such a threat that we and the Americans have decided to bomb them for trying to stop a genocide taking place. And they haven't killed anyone. All they threatened is what's the threat? The threat is to shipping lanes. To who? The corporations. That's who they threatened. They haven't threatened anyone. They haven't threatened a country. All they've said is you want to stop genocide taking place. They haven't even threatened Israel. All they're saying is we want to stop genocide taking place and we will not allow shipping that is going to Israel. That's all they've said. That's all they've done. And yet we've decided we're not bombing Israel or telling Israel to stop or putting sanctions on Israel. Far from it. We're giving them more weapons. We're giving them more support. We're covering them at the UN. We're vetoing any criticism of them. We're helping them along. Even Labour here and our governments here cannot bring themselves to say the word ceasefire. So all of this is corporations. I don't believe governments are in charge of anything anymore. This is clearly commercial interest, whether it's about real estate or whatever. But the level of atrocities and war crimes that are taking place and the lies and the constant lies and the blatant lies. Our Parliament, British Parliament, I mean, it just has, there's nothing left for it. We cannot stand up and say ceasefire. You know, October the 7th happened. 1,000 people, supposedly 700 people were killed. Now you've killed 30,000 people, 11,000 of which are children. Tell me how that makes sense. Genocide is not justifiable by anything that happened on October 7th. Genocide is not justified by, it has no context. It's not complex as everyone tries to make out. Genocide is simple barbarity and we all must stop it. Never again means never again for anyone, anywhere. And how we're using language now, what language means, and our political establishment cannot bring themselves to say one word, ceasefire. How much power does Israel have? Why are we afraid to criticize Israel? I don't get it. I absolutely don't get it. The most powerful voices right now against Israel are Jewish voices. They're standing up and saying this is wrong. Israeli voices, people in Israel protesting against what's going on. But the vast majority, I get it, the media has brainwashed these people in Israel. The language that they use, how they dehumanize the Palestinian population. I see it every day. The kids that are going into hospital, being taken in by their parents, they've got bullet shots through the middle of their foreheads. That is, snipers are there, Israeli snipers are there in Gaza right now, killing children, targeted. Do you remember when Al-Shifa Hospital, and there was a rocket attack on the car park, and a few hundred people died, and Israel screamed to the world, oh, this is a misfired Hamas rocket. That was Shifa Hospital. Yeah, and they made such an excuse. Since then, Israel has destroyed 36 hospitals. They don't even bother talking about it anymore. They don't even give you a reason as to why we've done it. And now they're poised to, they've been telling the people of Gaza to go from North Gaza, to leave because Hamas is there, go down south, go into the middle of Gaza, you're safe there. Then they said move from middle of Gaza down to the south of Gaza because you'll be safe there. Now that they're safe there, the last major town, Rafah, there are 1.5 million refugees that have come from other displaced people that have come from other parts of Gaza are now in that one small town. And now Israel is preparing to attack that one small town. There's nowhere else to go. This is an ethnic cleansing on an industrial scale, and I've never seen the likes of it. If you look at the video and the pictures coming out of northern Gaza, there's nothing left of it. It's just rubble flattened, and now bulldozers are going there, flattening it. They're literally just flattening the whole area. There's nothing to go back to. People, even if Israel tomorrow turns around and says, you know what, we'll give you a ceasefire. And they tell Israel, yeah, they can go back. Go back to what? They've destroyed the hospitals. They've destroyed the schools. They've destroyed the roads. They've destroyed the buildings where people live. They've destroyed the power centers. They've destroyed the water supplies. There's nothing for people to do. This is ethnic cleansing on an industrial scale done by the people that suffered the most in World War II. It's unimaginable, the utter frustration and the utter devastation. It was done to them, the same media, the same dehumanization, the same animals, the word of use of animals, we're going to kill them, proudly dancing in joy at the destruction that they're heaping on Gaza. The one girl, Rajab, young lady, 5 years old, she was killed being in a car with her family, and an Israeli truck, tank, whatever you want to call it, came up alongside, saw the family inside the car, and started shooting bullets into it, killed everyone except that one girl in the back of the car. She called the Islamic Red Cross. She called them. There's phone call records, evidence. The family called them before they started getting shot. You can hear them being shot. She calls the Islamic Red Crescent, this girl, after all her family's been killed. And she says, I'm alone. They've killed my family. I went myself. Please come and save me. And then you hear her being shot. This is happening to one family. It's happened. Entire families have been wiped from the face of this earth. There's no one left from that family. That generation is gone. Literally wiped out. They're destroying cemeteries. What? You're not letting people live, but you're not letting the rest dead. The dead rest. The Israeli army is digging up cemeteries in Gaza. They're literally wiping everything out. And it's not surprising. Their political leadership are saying exactly what their soldiers are doing. And the evidence is piling up. And our media in the West, what our media is saying, oh, how can we have such a breakdown of discipline in the Israeli army? What are you talking about? It's not a breakdown of discipline. They've been told to do this. They're following orders. It's not a breakdown of discipline when they're smashing up people's homes, when they're urinating on dead bodies, when they're taking pictures next to dead corpses, they are sharing that with glee. They're sharing what we're going to do. They sing songs about it around the campfires, what we are doing in Gaza, what we will do. We're going to kill every single one. And who's saying that to them? The Israeli politicians. Their president is saying it to them. Their prime minister is saying it to them. Their foreign minister is saying it to them. Their home minister is saying it to them. In open, Benny Gantz, the defense minister, you know what he said? And it's hardly reported by the Western media. He said, I have lifted all restraints on the Israeli army. That is chilling. What does that mean? It's just that one sentence, but what does that mean? He's basically telling his army, do what you want. Do you know the chief rabbi for the Israeli army? The chief rabbi that gives spiritual and religious counseling and guidance to the Israeli army? He says that it's okay for the Israeli soldiers to rape during times of war. To rape non-Jews during times of war. He's now the head of the Israeli, he's a general. He's the head of the Israeli religious services, the army's religious services. This is what we've got. Hardly, and it's covered, it's fig-leafed by the Western media.
All right, another final question for you, Farouk, which is what is in it for Britain? What is in it for America, the supporters of this?
What is it in it for them? Honestly, I'm so far at a loss to explain what advantage they get. I don't get it. We've lost the moral compass. But the only thing that makes any sense is that they get something out of it financially. That the people who are running Rishi Sunak, his investment company, has got contracts. BP, for example, they've discovered a massive gas oil field outside the Gaza, on the Gaza shores. Is that coincidence? Just before the start of the war? Is that coincidence? That while this war is happening, Israel has given contracts to BP to explore those gas and oil fields as this current war is taking place. Gaza belongs to the Palestinian people. The shores, 10 miles, belongs to the Palestinian people.
Well, I haven't seen Extinction Rebellion doing a big protest about that one. Okay, Farouk Sadiq, thanks very much for joining us again.